Blog Talk Radio.
Professor Fernando Uribe. I want to welcome you all here this evening, the 20th of September, year 2018. Folks, hope you all having a wonderful fall. Again, as fall begins this Saturday, and certainly for all my students, both past and present, hopefully the start of your semester is going well. As in addition to all my fellow educators, hope you had a wonderful start to the school year. To all my other young professionals, going back to work, sort of, you know, putting summer behind and moving forward as the fall and winter await. And of course, folks, you know, as the baseball pennant races heat up here, you know, playoffs are coming on October 1st here. I know a lot of us are glad the NFL is back. I know I am. Nice to see my Dallas Cowboys even their record at 1-1 after their very impressive defensive performance this Sunday night against the Giants. We'll see if we can get the 2-1 on the road in Seattle this Sunday. A very winnable game for my Cowboys, and we'll find out here. But the NFL's back. I know we're all excited about it. I know Sunday fun days certainly are things that we look forward to, not just here in New Jersey, but throughout the country as well, as we're, I'm sure, all devoted fans of the National Football League. Now, you go right to the show's inbox tonight, folks, politicallydirectnj@yahoo.com. Once again, politicallydirectnj@yahoo.com. Now, don't forget to follow the show on Instagram, at politicallydirectnj. You can also follow me on Instagram personally, @your_favorite_Fernando. Certainly you can follow me on Twitter, which is greatly appreciated, @ProfessorFUribe. And folks, if you have not done so, take a moment. For all you Facebook subscribers, click the like button on the page and tell your friends to do the same. 500 plus likes and counting, folks. Let's try to get to 600, hopefully by the end of the week. Of course, I appreciate all the love here on Politically Direct via Twitter, Facebook, or Instagram. Now, I do want to hear from you this evening, so don't be shy. Call me toll-free, 818-572-8032. Once again, toll-free number tonight, 818-572-8032. And again, our toll-free number is brought to you by Insider NJ. Now, don't forget to check out Insider NJ, ladies and gentlemen, by going to www.insidernj.com. Once you're on the main site, you can click on the subscribe button right at the very top, and you'll be enrolled absolutely free of charge in our morning intelligence briefing. So guess what? When you open your inbox in the morning, having coffee, maybe you're on the treadmill, maybe you're watching, I don't know, Fox Sports 1 or ESPN to start your morning, hey, read the morning intelligence briefing, the exclusive news only brought to you by Insider NJ. Folks, again, www.insidernj.com. Subscribe to the morning intelligence briefing, and you'll get the absolute best journalism available in the state of New Jersey. You know it's always courtesy of Insider NJ. Folks, again, 818-572. Love to hear from you later on the hour. We have a great guest coming up in just a few moments, so stay tuned for that. Again, a very, very important topic tonight we'll be discussing, so stay tuned. And folks, the opinions and views expressed tonight and every week here on Politically Direct are mine and mine alone. They do not represent those of Insider NJ, the management, the journalists, or the staff. Well, folks, you got me thinking today, as I always like to sort of pontificate on things. And I was starting to sort of, you know, evaluate what my opening monologue would be today. And certainly watching the news cycle and certainly seeing what's going on in Washington during the circus known as the Senate confirmation hearings concerning Judge Kavanaugh, it got me thinking about the blatant double standard by the liberal mainstream media. And I'm going to tell you about it. And that's the subject of my first shot. You know, folks, I'm someone who, again, and just to sort of dispel the myth, because I think sometimes people that write on the Facebook page for Politically Direct or my other podcast page, Talking to Hudson, tend to sort of have assumptions of what I am ideologically. Let me be very clear, and let me be very, very, you know, decisive in what I'm going to say here. I am not a registered Republican. I am not a registered Democrat. I am an independent, technically, but I have been registered for some time now with the Constitution Party. Now, for those of you who are not aware, certainly check out their website, www.constitutionparty.com. And you know what, folks? They're a very reputable and very established political party here, not just in New Jersey, but throughout the country. I've read their platform, and if you believe in the founding principles of our sacred document, then you'll appreciate the Constitution Party. But again, I'm not here to sell you on a political party. I'm here to sell you on the fact that, you know, more times than not, people tend to sort of make, assumptions about what I am ideologically. And folks, what I am really is someone that doesn't like the double standards by the liberal mainstream media. We all know that the mainstream media leans heavily to the left. I don't want to hear this nonsense about, oh, well, you know, well, what about Fox News? Folks, understand something, that if we name 10 newspaper or cable news or, you know, any type of nightly news type of operations, okay, we name 10 off the top of our heads, folks, 9 out of 10 are going to be liberal, overtly liberal, okay? Some are blatantly liberal. And then you have Fox News. But yet people, many on the left in this country, complain about Fox News. Well, how about the other 9 news operations that are heavily slanted to the left? And it got me thinking because, you know, one of the things that I wanted to sort of call out today is, listen, I've talked about it on the show. I've posted about it on social media. I think just Judge Brett Kavanaugh is an extremely qualified jurist. He is a dedicated family man, a devoted husband, a wonderful father, a guy that has done a lot philanthropically. He's a guy that has done a lot for his local community. He has done wonders by women in terms of who he's hired as law clerks. I mean, I talked about it last week. He has a very proven record with hiring female law clerks, regardless of ideology. He hires, you know, the best law clerks, but he's happened to hire a lot of female law clerks. And one of the things that I thought was really, really funny is, you know, all of a sudden now, remember, this is a guy who worked in the Bush White House going back to like 2000, between 2000 and 2004. And remember, he was heavily vetted before he took on that position. How come we never heard of, you know, a Professor Christine Blasey Ford back in 2000 to 2004? We never heard a peep out of her. We never heard a peep after 1982. We never heard a peep since 2004. Now, Camille, all of a sudden, when it's been, if you look at our social media, Professor Ford has become a blatant, not just anti-Trump, activist, but also sort of a very heavy radical liberal. And now all of a sudden, you know, these accusations surface, and now we're supposed to take them seriously. And what's funny is, you know, certainly, and unfortunately, our junior senator here in New Jersey, Cory Booker, continues to embarrass himself on the national stage. And I know he's desperate to win the nomination to run for president in 2020. But folks, the junior senator from New Jersey is facing accusations of hypocrisy today over his calls to sort of delay the confirmation vote of Supreme Court nominee Brett Kavanaugh amid, you know, these supposed sexual misconduct allegations, as Cory Booker once admitted groping a friend without her consent in high school. You know, the senator who again, recently has urged the Senate Judiciary Committee to first let the FBI conduct an investigation after California professor Christine Blasey Ford accused a high court nominee of sexual assault over 35 years ago. Well, guess what, folks? Cory Booker once wrote an article detailing an instance where he groped a female friend. Okay? So it reads like this. Here's a couple quotes from the article. Quote, New Year's Eve 1984, I will never forget. I was 15. As the ball dropped, I leaned over to hug a friend, and she met me instead with an overwhelming kiss. As we fumbled upon the bed, I remember debating my next move as if it was a chess game, Booker wrote in the student-run Stanford Daily newspaper in 1992 while he attended undergrad at Stanford University. With the Top Gun slogan ringing in my head, I slowly reached for her breast. After having my hand pushed away once, I reached my mark. He continued without explaining what he meant by mark. Our groping ended soon, and while no relationship ensued, a friendship did. You see, the next week in school, she told me that she was drunk that night and didn't really know what she was doing, he added. So Booker's intent of the column was to detail his transformation from a 15-year-old who was, quote, trotting around the bases and stealing second, to someone who was called a man-hater over his pro-women views. In retrospect, my soliloquy titled The Oppressive Nature of Male-Dominated Society and Its Violent Manifestations, Rape, Anorexia, Battered Wives, may have been a superstitious attempt to convince her that I was a sensitive man, but more likely I was trying to convince myself that my attitude had changed, he wrote. The now senator came back to the topic a few months later in 1992, penning another article that mentioned the controversial column, which he said was about, quote, date rape, and admitted that his actions were odd with his beliefs. By my second column, as I raised my noble pen to address the issue of date rape, I realized that the person holding it wasn't so noble after all, he wrote. With this issue, as with many others, a dash of sincere introspection has revealed to me a dangerous gap, a gap between my beliefs and my actions. Now, the columns by Booker, again, a potential 2020 presidential contender, has resurfaced after he became one of the leading voices of the Democratic opposition concerning Kavanaugh's confirmation. Following allegations of sexual misconduct against Kavanaugh, which he vehemently denied, Booker said the accusations are, quote, serious, credible, and deeply troubling. After the committee vote was delayed and Senate Judiciary Committee Chairman Chuck Grassley invited both Ford and Kavanaugh to testify on Monday, Booker called for an FBI investigation before holding a hearing. Paul Munshine, a very reputable columnist for the Star-Ledger, the largest newspaper in New Jersey, wrote Thursday that Booker's columns will put him in an awkward position amid the scandal rocking the confirmation hearings. Based on the Stanford Daily column, Booker should be giving Kavanaugh the benefit of the doubt as well. The point of it was that the future senator had a wake-up call and decided I will never be the same. Well, apparently, to no one's surprise, Booker's office pushed back strongly. Quote, this is Senator Booker now saying, this disingenuous right-wing attack, which has circulated online and in partisan outlets the past 5 years, rings hollow to anyone who reads the entirety of Senator Booker's Stanford Daily column. A spokesman for the senator has said, told the Associated Press. Folks, listen, you know, again, and this goes back to, as I've talked about before, the blatant double standard that exists within our liberal media. And, you know, I've read the column, I've read the excerpts online and everything, and sexual assault is nothing to laugh at. It's really nothing to minimize. But again, I want someone to explain to me. If you can explain tonight and tell me, that's fine. But again, I'm trying to get someone to explain to me that we're talking about 35 years ago. And remember, Judge Kavanaugh was vetted thoroughly before he took on a job with the Bush White House. And these accusations never came up. And now all of a sudden they're coming up? And now the liberal media is having a heart attack about it? While Senator Booker's columns, I think, raise concern, and no one's taking the senator to task? Folks, this is what I'm talking about when it comes to the liberal mainstream media. They like to have it both ways, and more times than not, they like to talk out of both sides of their mouth. And this is why a lot of the American public, including myself, don't trust the media, specifically the mainstream media. Why? Because they've been leaning heavily to the left for decades. Sooner or later, people are going to stop believing you, and guess what? I think we're seeing that little by little. Whether it's calling it fake news or attacking it, say what you want. People are losing faith in the liberal media. And you know what? They have no one to blame but themselves. And that's my first shot. Folks, toll-free number, 818-572-J. All right, folks, it's 8:15 here on the East Coast. It's my pleasure to welcome to Politically Direct the chair of the nonprofit organization here in the Garden State, the New Jersey Recovery Advocates, a good friend of mine, and she happened to appear on my local podcast last week. It's great to have her here on the statewide podcast for Insider NJ. Please welcome Lisa Gladwell. Lisa, how are you, sweetheart?
I'm great. Thank you, Fernando. Thank you for having me.
Well, listen, you were a godsend today, and certainly, I was happy to reach out last night with you and certainly have you on. And I know we had a great episode last week on my local podcast with Talk on the Hudson, but today is certainly a much bigger audience, certainly under the umbrella of Insider NJ, and I'm glad to have you on here today. And, you know, Lisa, one of the things that I was really impressed with you last week when you were on my local show, and then obviously meeting you in person at the New Jersey Recovery Walk and Rally at Liberty State Park, was really, you know, your dedication to raising awareness about substance abuse and being an advocate for those that, quite frankly, are struggling today. I know last week you threw some numbers out there that I'm hoping you'll throw out again this week about the overwhelming problem that substance abuse still poses to everyday Americans. We're talking about tens of thousands of people dying every year from substance abuse, and to see someone like yourself be such a strong advocate, I have to applaud you. But for those that are just listening to you for the very first time, what got you involved with the New Jersey Recovery Advocates, and more so, why are you such a staunch advocate for substance abuse recovery?
Thank you, and thank you for giving me the opportunity to talk about that a little bit. I've been in recovery for over 16 years. It's 16 years and one day at a time for me.
Mm-hmm.
I was not what we would call a first-time winner. I was trying to get sober for a while, and I would relapse and go back and forth, but it's something that I really wanted, and I struggled with it. I, at the time, had a great job. A nice home. I was comfortable, but there was something missing, and this was my drinking and drugging was causing a problem. So it took me a while. I kept at it, and I found it. But I found it through what I talk about. I call them strangers, and today they're my family. A gentleman had come up to me. My family did not understand what addiction was about. I'm a very strong-willed person and successful, but they didn't understand why I couldn't just stop, and I didn't understand either. And my family was disappointed, to say the least, and essentially cut me off. And it was it was a gentleman. His name was Dr. Bill Van Oost. He has since passed away, but he was a pediatrician who left the practice to found the Van Oost Institute for Family Living, which is was an outpatient treatment program for both alcoholics, addicts, and their families, whether it be their children, their spouses. Codependency is a huge thing with addiction. And Dr. Bill said to me, little white-haired gentleman, very polite, and he said, allow us to love you until you can learn to love yourself. And those words, I thought he was crazy. Who is this stranger who's saying this to me? What does he want? Everybody seemed to want something. I didn't get it. But I didn't have a lot of options. And so I listened to him. And I listened to the others who told me to trust the process and trust them. And I did. And it has been, you know, it's life on life's terms. Not everything has been wonderful. But I am the best person I can be today. I got the muck out. And for that reason, and especially in what Dr. Bill had said to me many years ago, I have continued to do the same for others, because that was done for me. I essentially got my life back. I have a peace that I didn't have when I was a child, and that's because I work on it every day, and it's now a pleasure and a blessing to work on Lisa, you know. And so also I belong to a 12-step fellowship, and the 12th step is giving back to others. And I do that on a I do a lot of giving back to the community, and it also reminds me of where I came from, where I could go with this disease, because it is a disease, and I could relapse at any time, but I keep it fresh and help others, and that's what makes me be the best Lisa I can be. That's a long sentence.
Well, no, Lisa, listen, I have to tell you that, again, you know, having met you in person and certainly having seen your dedication to it, I mean, you know, you bring up a great point right now in your narrative about that substance abuse is a disease. And yes, it is something that millions of Americans struggle with. And, you know, again, and I mentioned this last week in our show, my local show, and I'll sort of, it bears repeating again, but, you know, I'm someone, you know, who's over 40, and I remember, you know, you know, I remember, you know, the seeing Ronald Reagan.
Yep. Just Say No, Nancy Reagan.
Yeah, and seeing Ronald Reagan and Nancy Reagan there on primetime, it was a Sunday night, just on primetime, and I remember seeing them sit there and talk about the war on drugs and just, you know, those famous words by Nancy Reagan where she just said, just say no. And those became, you know, that became the rally cry by Washington and ultimately by all 50 states to really combat drug abuse and drug usage. And again, I don't want to become overly political tonight, but the reality is, and this is probably more the sociology professor in me, but we know that 30 plus years later, Lisa, the war on drugs has been an absolute failure. And I'm not trying to sound hostile to anybody. I'm not trying to sound cynical, but for all intents and purposes, you know, we've injected billions upon billions of dollars into this war on drugs, and it's
I
been
agree.
A failure. And you
yes.
know, one of the things that really I think has been disappointing, I think, is the fact that, you know, now with research, and, you know, again, you know, when I grew up, I've never done any drugs. I've never even smoked a cigarette. Like, that's just not who I am. I'm not better than anybody. I'm not worse than anybody. That's just me. You know, I'll smoke a cigarette on my birthday. That's it. And I'm a social drinker. But I understand that there are millions of Americans that struggle with alcohol, with recreational drugs. And quite frankly, you know, it's something that we cannot take lightly. We can't just say, oh, my goodness, you know, it's a choice. Come on, you know, have more discipline or have more, you know, more willpower. And mind you, Lisa, you know, I'm Hispanic, and something that's very prevalent in the Hispanic community is this notion of, like, you have to be disciplined. Come on, let's get with it. You know, don't be at the mercy of drugs or alcohol. Come on, you can – come on, put your head into it, you know, dedicate yourself, and you'll get over it. And the reality, though, is, Lisa, for millions of people, men, women, teenagers, you know, it's a disease. It's a disease that has to be treated the same way we treat other diseases, with help, with support, with, you know, with reinforcement. But for whatever reason, I think that only in recent years, though, we've seen that now that narrative has become a reality. I think it's taken a long time to get to that, right?
Well, I think it's come a long way because we, exactly what you said, we have spent billions of dollars on prevention, the Just Say No, the DARE program, the war on drugs, and it doesn't work. And when I say that, I'm sure there are folks out there and who have been influenced not to take a drink or drug. But for those of us, and it's in excess of 10% of the population, those of us who have this disease, Just Say No prevention does not work. It does not work. And until we start to address that and start putting some funding into recovery support, that 10% of the population is going to continue to suffer. And not only them. You know, this is a family disease. Their loved ones, you know, everyone in society suffers. This is if you don't have compassion, if you're just looking at the dollars and cents, this is the biggest epidemic, and it's affecting our economics. It's affecting every corporation, every family, every neighborhood. It's out there. And until we start to put some resources and acknowledge that recovery for those 10% plus of the population is the answer, and to help facilitate that answer, we are going to continue to throw our money down the drain. That's it. All those years and all those billions going into prevention, we are at epidemic stages. That tells me that that's a failure for many of those, and there's so little in by way of recovery support. I think the government is looking for a magic bullet, and it's just not there.
No, you're right. It just isn't there. And one of the things that's really disturbing to me is, I mean, again, I'll just speak for New Jersey. You know, one of the things, I think I mentioned to you off the air, is, you know, before becoming an academic, Lisa, you know, I worked in our criminal justice system for 10 years. I worked as a probation officer. I worked as a criminal investigator, and I worked at two of the busiest county jails in the state of New Jersey. I worked at Hudson County Jail and Essex County. And if you know both jails, I mean, they're busy. There's volume there. And I worked with very challenged populations of people that were struggling with drug abuse. I mean, you know, one thing is when you watch a movie, you know, growing up, you know, I'm a big movie buff. And, you know, one thing is watching movies and watching, you know, TV shows about drug abuse or drugs. But, you know, when you're in a jail and you're watching someone withdraw from heroin or other hard narcotics, I mean, you're seeing that. It's not a YouTube video. It's not a movie. Like, you're seeing it in the flesh. I mean, like, that left an impression on me, Lisa, that I'll never, like, I can still remember vividly walking through the jail and talking to the defendants and inmates that were struggling with getting representation or were struggling with drug usage. And I remember seeing people go through withdrawal. It was a disturbing image. It was something that, and I'm someone, you know, listen, I grew up a big horror film fan. I grew up a slasher fan. I loved horror films. But let me tell you, none of that prepared me for working with people that were struggling with abuse. And when I saw people go through withdrawal in county jails and there's nothing that you can do but just sit there and watch or try to interact with them, it is something that is overwhelming people. And I just think that the more education we have, the more education we need out, not just in our public schools and our universities, but in our criminal justice system, to really understand that substance abuse is just, it's a multi-layered problem, is it not?
Yes, it is. Yes, it is. And I agree. The withdrawal from heroin is what continues. The physical withdrawal is the first stage that folks, and it's the most apparent that people see. And for any addicted opiate addict, that is the quote-unquote high, that feeling that they had gotten or were seeking when they first tried opiates or had when they first tried opiates, they're no longer looking for that. They're looking to keep from feeling that sick. That's what it's about. They're stuck in a cycle. That's what withdrawal is. It's terrible. It's a horrible thing to watch.
No, it definitely is. And one of the things that I know, and folks, if you're just joining us right now on the East Coast, it's 8:30 here on Blog Talk Radio. It's my pleasure to have with us here tonight on Politically Direct the chair of the New Jersey Recovery Advocates, Ms. Lisa Gladwell, here on Blog Talk Radio, again, via Insider NJ. You know, Lisa, one of the things that caught my attention about the 2018 New Jersey Recovery Walk and Rally last Saturday at Liberty State Park was really, number one, the enthusiasm by not just yourself, but by everybody involved. But number two, also, I think you saw a very diverse group of men and women that were really, you know, passionate about raising awareness about substance abuse. And, you know, certainly in your time with the New Jersey Recovery Advocates, I mean, I'm sure that you've come across hundreds, maybe thousands of people that have been going through the same things you're going through or worse, God forbid. And, you know, they've also found, you know, again, sort of refuge in being able to get their life together and become clean and get healed. You know, what's been your experience as chair of this organization? Of course, I'm sure you started like anybody else, but then moving your way up as the chair, you know, what's been your experience like with New Jersey Recovery Advocates? And if you could tell our audience today about some of what their work entails.
Okay. New Jersey Recovery Advocates is, we are grassroots. We are of the people, for the people. We were founded 5 years ago by myself and a handful of others who believe that recovery is the solution for those who do have this disease. And what we wanted to do was to flip the dialogue. It's flipped the dialogue from being someone who is interested in spending their life sober and the best person they can be, which is a lifelong journey called recovery. We wanted to flip the dialogue from it being a negative. In other words, when you go to treatment, they give you tools. The tools, some of them that they say are change everything, change people, places, and things. I remember that when I was in early recovery and thinking that essentially my life was over in so many ways, you know, that I would never laugh again, I would never dance again, you know, how am I going to do this? And it took me a while to essentially learn to walk in sobriety and recovery. And it was uncomfortable because change is uncomfortable. So what we're trying to do is, instead of making making recovery a program of deprivation, which is stay away from people, places, things, don't do this, don't do that, instead we want to make it what it truly is, and that's a program of attraction. I have been blessed. It was hard work. But I have been blessed with a life that I never would be able to imagine. And I'm not talking a material life. I'm talking about internal peace, which I didn't have before. And this is, it took hard work. And we're trying to have people, those who are either in active addiction or their loved ones, be able to provide them with that hope, to give them a clear demonstration of what recovery looks like. It looks like everyone else. We look like everyone else. We celebrate, but there's something different. And what's different is we are trying, we're not perfect, but trying to be the best people that we can be. We are grateful for the fact that we're sober today. And we want to get as much and give as much in life on a daily basis. That's what we're trying to do, is flip the switch, and so that someone in active addiction will say, I want what they have, and give them the hope to say that they too can achieve it. And there is a path. There are many paths to recovery, but people don't know about them. And unfortunately, because of the stigma and shame, they isolate. And when you isolate, that is the greatest power that the disease of addiction has.
One of the things, Lisa, that they mentioned your narrative today, and it stood out for me listening to your speech last week at Liberty State Park, was really, you know, from personal experience, you know, I've had friends of mine, I've lost some friends because of substance abuse. I have a dear friend of mine who I know still struggles with alcoholism. I know that his father passed away, really, I think, after years of just sort of complications with alcoholism. And also, I think that, you know, he's a guy that, you know, did hit rock bottom already and has gotten his life back together. But it's one of those things where, you know, he's going to continue struggling to some point when it comes to alcohol. And it's sort of, I think the reminder came for me, like this past Labor Day weekend, we had gone away down the shore and we had rented a hotel for the weekend to crash down there. And, you know, like a lot of guys, you know, Lisa, you know, you go down there, you want to pregame before you go out, you know, we're getting dressed, I'm ironing my clothes. I'm having to, you know, we go to the liquor store, get a big bottle of Captain Morgan rum, Diet Coke, we're having a few drinks in the room before we go out, and you know, before we go out for dinner and then to go out for the night, you know, club hopping, whatever, you know, the typical stupid stuff we do. And something that stood out for me is the next morning, woke up in our hotel room, and you know, I was hungry, I was a little tired. Are you still with us here? Because I hear a bit of
yes, I'm still here. Yeah.
Okay, I heard some echo back there. I'm sorry. So we woke up the next morning, and, you know, I wasn't hungover, but I was a little tired. We got in late. I was hungry. I'm one of those guys that likes his coffee in the morning and some sort of breakfast. And he said, you know, Fernando, I'll go get some breakfast. Stay here. So I went back to sleep, Lisa, and I get up, and I said, do me a favor, man. Please bring me a coffee. He forgot. He brought food, but he forgot the coffee. And he said, well, we have diet soda. Just have soda with your breakfast. And I'm like, you know what? Okay, I'm a guy. Those are the things we do. I woke up, had eggs with toast and diet soda. That was my breakfast. And he looked at me and he was like, "Hold on a second, let me just." And he poured himself diet soda like me, but in his cup he just added some rum. This is like 9 in the morning before we went to the beach. And he looked at me and he goes, "You want something, bro?" And I was like, "No, I'm good, I'm good." And he goes, "You sure?" I'm like, "Yeah, I'm fine." And he goes, you know, and he just looks at me and he says, "You know, man, I wish I could do what you do. I wake up, I just want to have a drink with my breakfast." And I don't, Lisa, I don't know about you, but, and I'm sure you've heard that narrative from people, but that just sort of reminded me, like, wow, like, I'm very fortunate, you know. He's at a big disadvantage, and I don't know if that's something that, I don't know if it's something he'll ever get over.
Yeah, well, you have to want to. And that reminds me of a very common saying that we all laugh about, but it's about happy hour, and it's 5 o'clock somewhere, you know,
yeah.
Whether it be night, day, or whatever, and people use that, you know, to make light of their drinking. What's interesting in with your friend, and I think this is very important to note, folks will not opiate addicts. You will not die of a opiate withdrawal. As horrible as it looks, as terrible as it feels, you don't die from that. But you will die, you can die, from alcohol withdrawal. And that's why you will find, too, that folks who do have a significant alcohol abuse issue have to drink around the clock to maintain the alcohol in their system.
Well, I mean, one of the things that you just brought to light right now, and, you know, for me, you know, again, and I've known him for 30 years, and it's an issue that, you know, and it's one of those things for me that's sort of personal, because I remember, you know, we went to elementary school together, Lisa, for example, we went to high school together, and I'll never forget we graduated high school. It was the summer right before we, you know, were going to college, and we both went to Rutgers in New Brunswick, and we, you know, it was like, I think the week or two before, it was like in early August, where for those that aren't aware, you know, there is something called EOF, which is the Educational Opportunity Fund for a lot of students that come from, you know, lower socioeconomic statuses and receive financial aid for school. And I remember that he was a guy that, I mean, Lisa, when I tell you, this is a guy who did my math homework all 4 years of high school. He was like top three in our graduating class in high school. He was really, really brilliant. And, you know, that weekend, there was, you know, it was a Saturday morning. We were supposed to go to Rutgers for EOF orientation the night before one of our friends, you know, it's August. We're all going to be moving away to college soon. Some are moving out of state. And one of my friends had an end of summer party. And I'll never forget it as long as I live. I was 18 years old. And I remember going to this party. You know, we're 18, Lisa, and we're drinking. Yes, we're drinking underage. We're having, you know, we're partying. We're like, all right, well, let's get ready for college. And I'll never forget that he put himself in a really bad position where he got immensely sick. And we had to take him to Rutgers the next day, like, completely hungover. And it was sort of like a message to us, like, I don't know. I hope this isn't a sign of things to come for him when he gets to Rutgers. And sure enough, it became that. And, you know, he struggled throughout his life with alcohol. He got it under control a couple of years ago. And, you know, he's just, I think, you know, he understands it's a disease, but I think he's sort of taken this approach, and he's been lucky that, you know, he understands he has to be productive. He has to work, he has to make money, pay the rent. And we still go out socially. We still go out socially to drink. I know he doesn't drink as much anymore because he just knows his body can't tolerate it. But, you know, I wish sometimes that maybe everybody was like him, in a sense where maybe they're realizing the damage and maybe they're taking the initiative. But as we talked about before, it's a disease. And sometimes you can have all the discipline you want, but when it's going to overwhelm you, it's going to overwhelm you, right?
I absolutely agree. And there are lots of folks who, you know, I went through the college days, the high school, all that stuff with a lot of friends. And at times, you know, my friends, too, would, you know, drink too much, party too much, and they would get sick or whatever that may be, you know. But that can be considered alcohol misuse. When it becomes a disease, I'm not sure. When I have no idea when I crossed the line, if it was always with me or what that trigger was. I don't remember. I don't think there was a particular time that where I became conscious of the fact that this was it. Yesterday I was okay, and today I have a disease. I don't know when that time came. But what I found and what I tried to do for a while, when I realized that at times I could not handle or I could not control what I was doing, I would try and control my drinking, you know, my partying. And you know, that was, for me, it was difficult. And why? Now I know it's because I had a disease and I was unsuccessful. I may have been successful 2, 3, 4, 5 times, but I would always go back to the point where I had no off switch, you know, when I knew that day would come unless I abstained completely. And that's when I realized that I have a disease. And I realized today, and not only through my own experience, but through others around me, that I cannot risk taking that chance. You know, we have a saying, one is too many and 1,000 is not enough. And that's the way it works, because the off switch in with folks with the disease of addiction, there is no off switch. Once you have turned that switch on, your choices become very limited unless you abstain completely.
Well, you know, that's a very interesting word, Lisa. And when we talk about abstain, we know that thousands of New Jerseyans struggle daily with abstaining from alcohol.
Absolutely.
Or other substances. And it's a struggle. And, you know, again, I don't want to get overly political here, but as we know that, you know, New Jersey has a new governor. You know, he's only into his 8th month here. But in the previous 8 years, Governor Christie had a specific sort of platform when it came to drug usage. And, you know, again, I don't want to sort of, you know, rain on his parade, but, you know, at the very end of his tenure, when his legacy was pretty much shot, you know, I applaud Governor Christie for really being out at the forefront about opioid use and abuse. And maybe it was a little too late in his administration. But the fact is that, you know, the current governor, the former governor, and even governors before them have all had positions about drug usage in New Jersey. Could you share some numbers tonight? I mean, again, we're not trying to scare people, but to really put in perspective how serious a problem it is here in New Jersey.
Well, one of the things that I spoke about, which when I looked up the statistics, I'm not a big statistics person. I live with this disease when I am just with myself, but also I help those who are struggling to find their way. And so I see I'm grassroots, boots on the ground. So statistics aren't my thing, but I found some last week that were astounding, and they had to do with Narcan. Narcan is its generic name is naloxone. And it's made by a very small company out of Ireland called ADAPT, ADAPT Pharmaceuticals. Everyone has heard of Narcan now. Narcan reverses an opioid overdose. It unfortunately doesn't work well on because of the strength of fentanyl and cartfentanil and some of the others. But for heroin and other opioids, it has saved a lot of lives. And the statistics, this is in Jersey alone, that I came across last week, were for law enforcement and EMTs only, in 2016, they did 10,000 plus Narcan saves. That's people they brought back to life. This is in 2016. 2017, there were in excess of 14,000 Narcan saves. That means people brought back to life. We went from 10 to 14. And 2018, we are now trending towards 18,000 Narcan saves. That tells me that people are, that we are, number one, this quote-unquote war on drugs, or getting on the winning side of opiate abuse, is not working with what we're doing now. That's what that tells me. I mean, that's, thank goodness, we're tracking at 18,000 people whose lives will have been saved. But what do we do with them? What do we do with them? You save their life, and what? Some can make it into treatment. Some, you know, can have the ability to find their way to a 12-step program. You know, some will go right back out. New Jersey is employing now in various agencies and hospitals, et cetera, recovery coaches who will meet someone after a Narcan save. They'll meet them at bedside. And they're folks with at least a couple years of recovery who have gone through training to become a recovery specialist or a coach. And they try and convince these folks who have just overdosed to go into treatment. And you know, we have the next problem, with which is not enough beds to house all these people who are willing to get treatment. And then, and this is kind of what our organization is about, what do we do when we're done? For those lucky enough to get into treatment, who are willing and lucky enough to get in, what do you do with them? You know, 28 days is not enough. That's enough to get you sober, to get the drugs and alcohol out of your system. Then what do? You say you're fixed. They're not fixed. They have a disease. And this disease is a lifelong disease. And so treatment provides you with some tools while it gets you into a sober state. But then what do with the rest of your life? This is why we have frequent relapses. This is why there are not enough treatment beds, because people are going through them multiple times. The ones who are lucky enough to live long enough to go through them multiple times until they find a foothold in recovery, or, unfortunately, some have to die. And that's just not acceptable. So, you know, I do believe, I know the recovery movement is growing, thank goodness, but it's not fast enough. Fernando, this year, 72,000 people in the United States will lose their life to an overdose. And that is completely unacceptable. Go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, based on those numbers you just gave us tonight, I mean, folks, if you're listening in here tonight, just to put in perspective that number, think about Yankee Stadium being filled for two home games, completely sold out. That's the amount of people that are going to be dying in New Jersey. So if you have trouble trying to visualize what 72,000 people look like, think about two Yankee home games being sold out, and guess what? That's what you're looking at. So that's a scary visual, though, Lisa. Please continue. I just want to sort of put that out there for our audience.
No, and it is. These are the numbers, unfortunately, that keep me going the way I'm going, you know? I mean, to save one life is a beautiful thing, because you save one, the ripple effect is phenomenal. But we have 72,000 lost opportunities every year. And why? Because we are emphasizing prevention, which obviously has not worked for many. Then we have insufficient treatment and certainly not long enough for many of these folks. And then we have nothing afterwards. And that's what, you know, the purpose of nonprofits are to fill in the gaps where the government doesn't, for those who require some type of services or charitable benefit. And I have a lot of things to do with my time, lots of things. that I'd like to do. But with these horrible statistics, you know, that are staggering, I find it very difficult not to speak up and not to be there, because these are lives, these are people, these are human beings who are existing while they're using an active addiction, whose families are suffering, and unfortunately for 72,000 this year, they're not going to have, they're going to lose their battle with addiction. And their families will never be the same. And so, quite frankly, society will not be the same.
Lisa, one of the things here in New Jersey that I think is very perplexing when it comes to looking at how to address substance abuse is, I mean, again, listen, we incarcerate a large amount of people every year, and we'll get to why they incarcerate people in terms of certain drug laws that need to be revamped immediately. But, you know, we've seen that New Jersey has spent a lot of money for decades now on drug treatment and substance abuse recovery, but it's still not enough, right? I mean, it's one of those things where I don't have the number in front of me, but I believe New Jersey spends anywhere between, somewhere between maybe $5 to $10 million a year, I think, on substance abuse programs and recovery programs. Maybe that number is low. Maybe, I don't know, but I think that's
five
the last
to ten
I
million.
At it.
Very low. And big,
yeah.
It sounds very low. And by way of treatment, it probably is too high for recovery, because they do not spend enough in regard to recovery services. But treatment, we are spending a fortune, whether it be for within the the penal system or otherwise, and it's still not enough, because that revolving door keeps people in this cycle of active addiction, sobriety, active addiction, sobriety. That's the way it goes back and forth like a ping pong ball until they find their way out or they die.
Well, one of the things that stands out for me about your organization, Lisa, is the fact that, I mean, again, you're very much out in the forefront. You're very active. Certainly, I saw the great turnout you had at the recovery rally and walk last Saturday at Liberty State Park. But moving forward, one of the things that I really wanted to sort of pick your brain about tonight, and I know we talked about last week on my local show, but I think it's important for the statewide audience to really get a bit of understanding. I've had different advocates. I've had elected officials on this show since its inception in January. And one of the biggest talking points right now in New Jersey, Lisa, is not just only the decriminalization of marijuana, which I think is vital from a not so much from a social justice perspective, but I think it's from a law enforcement perspective. I think we're incarcerating way too many people, black and brown people, white people as well, on marijuana possession. Now, again, I'm not someone that has a vested interest in this, because if it's legal tomorrow, I'm not going to start smoking. I don't care about it. For me, I'd rather have a glass of wine, to be honest with you, than smoke marijuana or do anything else. That's just me. But another important talking point we're seeing in New Jersey now, Lisa, is this insistence on, well, you know, it's worked in other states, it's raised revenues, it's important to try to, you know, help fund our public schools, to help build our roads. You know, we've all heard the rhetoric about marijuana legalization, and we've heard, oh, it works in other states, and we've seen that it could work here in New Jersey. But my problem, Lisa, is quite honestly, you know, you can't put the genie back in the bottle once you decide
Absolutely.
To legalize marijuana recreationally. And again, you know, I don't want to start sounding like, I remember I was talking about this a few weeks ago, and one of my friends called me up and said, dude, you realize you're starting to sound like our parents, right? I'm like, well, it's not about sounding like our parents, but, you know, I worked in our criminal justice system. You know, one of my master's degrees is in criminal justice. I you know, one of my thesis, as a matter of fact, was the importance of decriminalizing marijuana. You know, we incarcerate people at an astounding rate in New Jersey. Those are millions upon millions of dollars that we're wasting, as far as I'm concerned, to arrest people for marijuana possession, where it could infinitely ruin their lives. You know, certainly for my students, they could lose financial aid. People will, you know, get incarcerated. They can't afford an attorney. I mean, the, you know, it's millions upon millions of dollars that we're wasting when it comes to law enforcement. I think if we decriminalized it, I think we could better use those resources and manpower to either invest in either more treatment programs or something else. But when we're talking about outright legalization, Lisa, I don't know how you feel, but I'm concerned because every state's different. Just because it works in Colorado, which isn't as densely populated as New Jersey or Washington State or other states, it doesn't mean it's going to be a home run here in New Jersey. Am I sort of engaging in hyperbole here, or do I have a right to be concerned?
I believe you have a right to be concerned. And although, you know, for me, it's not going as an individual, it's not going to make a difference because I am not going to one day at a time engage in any mood altering substance. I do know that the very, very wealthy legalization lobby here wants to here in Jersey who have been plowing their way through. They are not talking about all the societal issues that legalization of marijuana will bring up. Colorado, it is not a slam dunk. There are a lot of issues, secondary issues that are happening there, and Washington, et cetera, due to the legalization of recreational marijuana. So it, you know, the power of money when it comes time for government, whether it be in with lobbyists, whether it be in taxes, is very, very strong. You know, and I don't serve that same master, but I think from a income standpoint, this is going to pass because the governor believes that it will help with some of New Jersey's fiscal challenges right now, but in reality. The social costs for those who will start using this mood-altering drug is going to be huge. A lot more difficult to measure than taxes, but it's going to be long-term, and it's a problem. When I say that, also science has indicated, and this is a concern from a personal perspective and a societal perspective, is that the part of your brain that exercises judgment and emotional maturity doesn't mature completely till the age of 26, approximately 26. And when we start legalizing, and it's no different with alcohol, but when people start anesthetizing and taking what are mood-altering substances, they are not exercising the judgment part of their brain. They are not developing it. And that in itself is the cost to society is going to be phenomenal. You know, these are folks we talk. I've heard the term these kids, these young folks nowadays. I say young folks because substance abuse is on the increase with young folks, and a lot of them don't need rehabilitation. What they need is habilitation, and that is learning to live. When you're anesthetized with a mood-altering drug, you are not exercising your capability of living life on life's terms. How many folks have been prescribed medicines, whether it be a pill or otherwise, for anxiety, for depression? Now, these are real mental illnesses or challenges for some, But the mood-altering substances that are oftentimes either prescribed by a doctor or by a friend or advice are not helping to get through what is situational and what is part of learning to live. You know, it's a rite of passage to be uncomfortable, you know, to have anxiety. We have to learn to deal with it. That's how we grow. That's how our judgment center matures. That's how we learn to cope with life on life's terms. Mood-altering drugs, mood-altering substances don't allow us to cope on our own with life on life's terms.
You know what, Lisa, that's well said. And something I wanted to sort of ask you tonight, because I'm trying to confirm his appearance on the show later in October, but I'm looking forward to having Governor Murphy on. If you were sitting across from Governor Murphy today and he was going to ask you, Lisa, I want to address drug recovery, substance use recovery. I want to address advocacy today. If you're sitting across from the governor, I know it's maybe a very multi-layered conversation. What would you like to tell the governor, or what would you like me to ask the governor in terms of a better job of addressing substance abuse? What would you say to Governor Murphy today?
Well, first I would find out if he's really interested or if it's just a soundbite. And that's not just for him, for others too. I don't know him. He was unable. He declined our invitation to the New Jersey Recovery Walk and Rally, but so did Governor Christie. What I suggest he does, and I think this is part of the problem with both his administration and the one before and most government, is that they don't know what's going on. You know, what's going on the boots on the ground. You know, how many of these folks have experienced, with the exception of a tour maybe and a photo op, you know, a drug unit in the jail. You know, how many have walked Van Houten and Rosa Parks Boulevard in Patterson? You know, and spoken with the folks there who are living in abandoned buildings, you know, without shoes and selling themselves just to, you know, get their next fix so they're not sick. You know, I don't see that type of interest. And part of that, I think, is stigma. You know, unfortunately, and this is kind of sad, but it popped into my head today. You know, everybody loves puppies and kittens, you know, because they're really cute when they're small, you know. And similar to that, any prevention is geared towards children. Children are innocent. They're beautiful. They're small. They're cute. So very easy to deal with prevention. But guess what? Those, just like those kittens and puppies grow up, children grow up, and they don't become less valuable as they get older and because they have a disease. And quite frankly, not everyone, but too many people, you know, through judgment, choose not to see these people and know that they have feelings. They are human beings just like everyone else. They just have a disease. And I don't know what government does, whether it be here in Jersey or elsewhere, you know, how their people are out there on the street and really seeing what is going on. You know, if so, quite frankly, there would have been more government representation and support of the recovery rally and recovery services in the first place. There'd be a lot more resources, and quite frankly, then government would know what they're talking about. You know, I don't see that yet. They're going to have to. They're looking for a solution, but unfortunately, we live in a, you know, take a pill and everything will get fixed, you know, an instant gratification society. This is not one of those issues, and we need government to realize that and get involved, get in the weeds with the folks who are living with this these on a daily basis who are suffering in active addiction, as well as those who have found a solution?
You know, it's interesting that you bring that up because it's a multi-layered type of problem solving, Lisa, when it comes to addressing this. And you brought up a very interesting point right now when referring to not just the traditional means of substance abuse, but now, and I mentioned this last week, and I'll sort of embarrass repeating again to our audience here on Politically Direct, is, you know, one of the more interesting documentaries I have seen on Netflix was called Take Your Pill. And it's about two years old, and it shed light on a very, you know, again, we know about the traditional aspects of substance abuse, whether it's alcohol, whether it's recreational drugs. Now what we're seeing for the last 10 years, I think really, and only now is it getting the attention that it should have gotten a while back, was the sort of fixation now on prescription drug abuse. And as someone who works in higher education, I talk to my college students often, and this documentary was great. And for everyone listening, if you have not seen it, it is on Netflix. It's called Take Your Pill. It's about 90 minutes long. It is one of the more informative and illuminating documentaries you'll ever see about prescription drug use. But it really sheds light now on the usage of not just college students, Lisa, but now working professionals that work in high-stress environments, whether it's in finance, whether it's in Silicon Valley, out in California, or in the IT world, where, quite frankly, the misuse and abuse of Adderall and other prescription drugs is spiking exponentially, and it's scary. And I've looked at some of this research, and quite frankly, I don't know why it's not getting the attention it should get, but I'll tell you, I've talked to my students, Lisa, and I, you know, right around final exam time, I've talked to my students and said, hey, listen, I'm not going to rat you out on anything, but I'm just curious, who's been reaching out to classmates or friends because they need Adderall? And it's startling the amount of people that raise their hands, Lisa, that students that tell me this, because it's an epidemic now, not just for college students, but also for young professionals that need Adderall to be able to get through 15, 18-hour workdays. I think it's crazy. What do you think?
I absolutely agree with you. And I graduated law school in 2010, and that was a big boost, you know, for around finals time for a lot of the students at law school, too. It's just well known, and people do it. I obviously didn't, but there are those that do. And what's to stop, folks, once you have a pill that seems to work situationally, you know, what's to stop you? When do you draw that line? You've already crossed it. You know, if it works for school, then why wouldn't it work to help you, you know, make it through that 14-hour day? And what about tomorrow and the next day? When do we stop doing this? We are on a hamster wheel here, you know, and we can medicate ourselves into oblivion, you know, and you know, if you listen to Go Ask Alice, you take a pill to go up, you take a pill to go down. You can. Why are we doing this? I don't know. My guess is those are addiction is just a symptom of what's going on in our society.
Well, you know, and it's symptomatic of a very big problem where, like you said, I mean, we're starting to become so heavily dependent on medication for anything and everything. And it's startling. I mean, I'm looking at some numbers, you know, I'm looking at some numbers, Lisa, where I'm seeing men, women, and teenagers now becoming so dependent and becoming so prone to this usage that, quite frankly, I don't know if there's an ending in sight. And my legitimate fear, I think, is, you know, why is there such an utter disregard? Why is there not more of an awareness about what to do with these sort of these epidemics? And, you know, at least with your work and your advocacy, though, you know, what type of impact has your organization made statewide that you can share with our audience tonight?
Repeat that.
Well, in terms of, you know, your advocacy, how much of an impact has New Jersey Recovery Advocates made with different populations throughout the Garden State in terms of not just advocacy, but trying to direct people to the right resources, maybe helping them obtain treatment, or counseling? You know, how successful has New Jersey Recovery Advocates been to helping, you know, New Jerseyans?
Well, I hope we're successful. And when I say that, I don't want it to be a cop out. I mean, we are again a group of grassroots volunteers who are doing this as volunteers who are passionate. A few of us work in the field. Most of us do not. We just want to help people. We don't refer. We don't take government money to refer. We're not professionals. So, but when people reach out to myself, I have a lot of networking people out there, that I know who I can, find resources. But this is not something, that we have a hotline or anybody does on a regular basis. When I say it, who does that as a job in any way, shape or form, except it becomes part of our life. I'm not the only one. All of us, because we are passionate, help others. I believe, you know, it's hard to measure. I know the recovery movement is growing. I know we are a big part of it, our September event. I run into people all the time year-round who talk about that they were, you know, at their first sober recovery walk and rally in, you know, 2015, and I've been good since, and that's wonderful. But we don't have KPIs or key performance measures in regard to that. We do know we are making a difference. We do know we are part of the movement, and a significant part. And every time that we get on a any type of public relations or the ability, thank you for that, to let me talk on the show, we can spread the word, you know, about addiction and that there is a solution out there. I do know that there were folks at the rally last week who, for the first time in a public place, said that they were in recovery. That may not sound like much to someone, you know, to others, but to them, it was a significant moment because it changed from the point of shame to the point of you know, being something that they're proud of. You know, we are so much more than our disease. You know, and people have a hard time because this is because of the judgment and the stigma that's out there. People don't want to identify themselves as having this disease. And unfortunately, they suffer silently, and I'm not a proponent of that. I do know that there's no reason to do that, and but people are afraid.
Well, it certainly is a struggle for many New Jerseyans, and I'm glad that we have great, good-hearted people like yourself that are leading the charge and not just raising awareness, but giving people a lifeline when it comes to recognizing substance abuse and pursuing, the necessary path to recovery. But, like any other nonprofit and grassroots organization, Lisa, I mean, certainly at some point in time, what does the New Jersey Recovery Advocates do, or what's sort of the blueprint for them to, to stay afloat, to be self-sustaining? Is it really the hard work of getting donors or sponsors or maybe trying to apply for government grants? What have been some of the challenges for the organization to continue afloat, of course, and then also to be prominent in making a difference and staying consistent with that?
Okay. Well, what keeps us consistent is the fact that we have a very important mission goal and very important mission and goals. And we are working very hard every day, you know, because they're very lofty, to end discrimination and the stigma, and to make recovery a program of attraction. And I did study nonprofits in law school, and I consider myself pretty ethical, and our bylaws are pretty good. So we do keep on path. On target. I'm also not a believer. I've seen organizations go down the drain by chasing money. We don't chase money. Each one of us would prefer not to be doing this, but there is an epidemic out there. You know, when recovery becomes quote unquote normalized, like HIV/AIDS and cancer, then we won't have to be doing this type of work. And you know, there'll be other support systems that will crop up, you know, with different agencies, et cetera, and the government will be supporting them. So we need for this event every year. I go out and I try and raise funds, and from a corporate level, there are very unfortunately. I found corporations, very few have consciences, although they all like to talk about their community relations. They aren't. This is not a popular cause. Even those corporations that make a lot of money off of this population, they do not want to publicly acknowledge any support. And, again, that's quite a challenge. For those whose families who are in active addiction, whose families are in the throes of dealing with someone with active addiction, generally there is not a lot of resources that they have to give to the recovery movement. So this is a very, very vulnerable population, and it's not one that's self-sustaining. So we have to go elsewhere. And the other part of that is, you know, I research my porta potties to my, you know, to our production team and et cetera. There, any money that we do take in, we certainly, you know, make sure that it's used efficiently and effectively towards what we're trying to do. I will say in April, we had our first Bergen County event. It was a poker run. It was, unfortunately, it was during one of those nor'easters, or it was probably not even 50 degrees. We had it at a park, and it was lovely. We didn't raise money for scholarships for treatment for Bergen County individuals, and we had donated, I believe it's 10 scholarships from treatment places. And what we were doing was raising the money to supplement those scholarships. So these are things that we can do that are concrete in the community and make a difference in people's lives. And we do get local support for that. But again, it's a lot of boots on the ground, you know. And when you are dealing, you know, it's because of the quote-unquote war on drugs, I don't want to use that word, but it is a battle every day, you know, to sustain recovery efforts when there is not a lot of funding out there or even recognition in any way, shape, or form. I do know eventually there will be, because this is the only solution. Whatever that path to recovery is, it's the only acceptable, human, compassionate answer for our society. And eventually things will change, but in the meantime, people are dying. And I need to do my part, you know, to help those who are still sick and suffering.
Well, I have to tell you, Lisa, you know, the way you mobilize and how organized you are with this grassroots movement as it pertains to the New Jersey Recovery Advocates, I mean, it's absolutely inspiring. And I have to just ask you, what loss would you go to?
I went to Pace in White Plains.
Okay, very nice. Excellent. Okay, very nice. And, you know, one of the things that stands out for me concerning your status and really the star that's shining on you is the fact of how active you are, and you're so you're so vocal, and I have to tell you that, you know, people that are dealing with recovery, you know, people in New Jersey that are dealing with substance abuse, I mean, you know, if you're listening tonight, and certainly if you have a family member or a friend or a colleague, anybody that's dealing with substance abuse, I mean, I urge you, please check out Lisa's website and organization, www.NewJerseyRecoveryAdvocates.org. They're a wonderful organization, and Lisa's been a stand-up lady tonight, being on the air with me for over an hour. I'm sure after a long day, you've been an absolute peach tonight to come on the air and be with me as long as you have. Just a couple more minutes of your time, though, Lisa, if you can.
No, please, I live this.
You know, for the rest of 2018 and going into 2019, what are some events or maybe important workshops or even town hall forums, for example, that your organization is going to be hosting that our audience should know about?
Okay. Well, we have, we launched about, I guess it's about a year and a half ago. I happen to live in Bergen County, and a couple of our board members do also. So we started launching community forums for leaders, for recovery leaders in Bergen County. And these are people, these aren't the informational sessions, the town halls that go around and identify drugs and people come up and you know, talk about what it was like when they were using and what it's like now. This is a little bit, I don't want to say advanced, but people who already get that, they don't need the shock value. They don't need to learn about addiction. They know from whatever perspective it is, and they've made a choice to do something, to take action. You know, it's... you know, it's one of those, as one of my mantras is, if not me, then who? And so we host once a month. It's been at Transition Professionals, which is a reentry organization here in Bergen County, a fabulous reentry nonprofit. That is run by Bonnie O'Brien over in Hackensack. So we host our meetings there the second Monday of every month. It's on our website. We have a guest speaker, and then we talk about recovery issues, where we're going, what the people in this area, and it's not just for Bergen County. The meeting happens to be in Bergen County. We talk about what can we do for advocacy. That's where the springtime polka run came from, because the folks who had come had said, what can we do for people who are falling through the cracks without insurance, who do not qualify for Medicaid or whatever, who you know, have expended all their insurance and need treatment. And so we developed that polka run. But again, that's a local grassroots effort that is going on. Again, the second Tuesday, the second Monday of every month, a guest speaker last month was Charles Valentine from the Valentine Foundation. He was also a Russ Berry Award winner for his work. He runs... sober houses for men and women. I think they have four or five now. So we talked about starting a sober house. We've had the prosecutor, Bergen County prosecutor, in, who is now our attorney general, wonderful gentleman. We have had Children's Aid and Family Services, the Center for Drug and Alcohol Resources, some of their recovery specialists, the recovery coaches that go into, who answer calls in the hospitals and try and encourage people to go into treatment. We've had them speak. We've had Alumni in Recovery, which goes, they're a group of recovering young folks who go back to the high schools that they graduated from and speak to the students. Very, very powerful. So we have a guest speaker every month, and then the rest of it is talking about what can we do, what are we going to do here to make a difference. And people come in with questions about, issues that they in particular they have. And usually because of the breadth of people across within the room, there will be answers. If there's not an answer, somebody has a resource that will get an answer. And that's the way we operate. That's how we learn.
You know, again, Lisa, you're a shining example of someone who's very resilient and, again, having a lot of perseverance. And, you know, if for anyone listening tonight that's struggling with substance abuse, or, again, you have a friend, family member, colleague, I mean, look no further than my guest tonight, because this is a woman who really got her life together and is helping others get their lives together. And that's something that, you know, I'm clapping right now. I know you can't hear it, but I'm clapping for you, Lisa. And I really am. And before I let you go, again, I want to thank you again for your appearance tonight. I think you've been an absolute center of knowledge for our audience this evening. Really, one of the things about this show is that, you know, it's called Politically Direct, but one of the things I take a lot of pride in is not just about talking, you know, discussing New Jersey politics, but discussing New Jersey issues. And certainly substance abuse and the importance of recovery is an issue that I know is monumentally important to all New Jerseyans. And I want to thank you again for coming on tonight. And, you know, what we've done for the last hour, I think we've had a very illuminating conversation. But, you know, I've been here grilling you, asking you questions. And now I'm going to give you the floor. So if you got a question or two for me, fire away. You know, I like to give my guests the opportunity, you know, to kind of grill me a little bit, since I've put you on the hot seat today. And we've had a very, very productive conversation. So do you have anything for me this evening?
I would love to. Well, how would you suggest, coming from a different background than I, and having a lot of knowledge about the political system? Again, this is a nonpartisan issue. It is a human issue. It is about
Certainly.
It's a societal issue, and it doesn't matter to me which side anyone is on. And again, it's if nothing else, if you don't care about anybody else out there, and you value money, you know, this is a very expensive epidemic, and money, good money, is being thrown, and it's not being utilized, as efficiently or as effectively as it should. That being said, I try to stay away from politics.
Sure.
I just don't have the time. And how do you suggest that we make inroads, the recovery movement, with the powers that be in government, so that they are educated about, the scope of this, the what the solutions are, and to put their resources in the right places? That's a loaded question.
I'm more happy to answer it. I would say that in 2018, Lisa, we have seen for some time now the impact and the effectiveness of social media. And really, I think it's so vital for organizations to really take the social media and not necessarily be slanderous or malicious in terms of how they speak about government, specifically in Trenton. I have a lot of issues with the legislature, of course, because of how expensive it is to live here. But one of my bigger issues as well, I think, with the legislature, I would say, is that I think it's important for us, the citizenry, to really mobilize, to have as many rallies as possible, to get on social media, to blow up websites, to blow up the Twitter feed, I think, of our elected officials, and say, you know, this needs to be addressed. I think, you know, we find money in New Jersey to, we find the excuse to raise the gas tax because we need to fix our roads and bridges. And, you know, now it turns out we need to raise the gas tax again, or a plastic bag tax, or a tax on this, or a tax on that. I think it's really important for us as the citizenry to really get on Trenton and our legislators to really reassess every year, especially around budget time, to really appropriate more resources when it comes to recovery programs and treatment. And I think the best way to do that is, you know what, it's one of the things that drives my parents crazy, but I know I've always been this way since I was a kid, and I'm going to continue to be this way, and it's, I think it's one of the reasons why I host this show. And, I think being a pain in the ass gets you places. I think being a pain in the ass is going to get you attention, and it's going to get you the face time that sometimes you need with elected officials and to really make a difference. You know, you can write letters and emails, and that's great, and I urge my listeners say to do that, you know, write to your elected officials, but take the social media, you know, be respectful, be tasteful, but go out
of
there,
course.
Or organize, rally, you know, get people involved. You know, again, you know, one of the things about social media that I think people forget is that very much like the internet, you know, the internet's only about 25 years old. You know, it's only a quarter of a century. It doesn't seem like a long time. And social media really has only been around for, I'd say, maybe, you know, 11 years now. You know, Facebook first, you know, was activated online in 2007. We saw Twitter follow a couple of years after that. Then we saw Instagram recently and Snapchat. It's really important, I think, for not just grassroots organizations, at least I think it's important for regular people to really make some noise. And I think that that's something I do on a regular basis. I use my Twitter responsibly. I use my Instagram responsibly. I try to use my Facebook responsibly and raise awareness about issues like this. I mean, last Saturday when I went to the recovery walk, number one, I felt privileged to be there. Two, I felt very grateful to meet you. And three, I felt very relieved that, man, there are people out there that care. And I put it on blast. I blasted it on my Instagram. I blasted it on my Facebook. I blasted it on my Twitter. And I'm going to continue doing that because that's the only way. You know, you have to make noise. And I think as long as you keep making noise and keep getting in the face of elected officials, sooner or later they're going to break, because sooner or later they're going to have to pay attention to you. Like, there's no way to ignore you. And I think that's probably a good first step for us tonight, Lisa.
Okay. And I appreciate it. And I appreciate your social media attention for last week and the week before and what you've done. That's, and what that means is you're authentically walking the walk, and I so appreciate that.
Oh, well, that's nice of you to say. I appreciate the kind words. And again, Lisa, I want to thank you tonight for taking the opportunity to speak with us. And certainly half the battle with this show is getting worthwhile and very reputable guests on here to discuss the issues that matter to New Jersey residents. And you're just another one in a list of impressive guests on this show. So I want to thank you. I hope that you have a great rest of 2018. I certainly will get you back on by the end of the year. I want to get an update with you in terms of the strides and progress you're making with the organization. And stay awesome. God bless you. Keep doing good work. And thank you for being a fan of not just Talking to Hudson, you know, my local podcast, but being a fan of Politically Direct here with Insider NJ.
And a fan of yours. Fernando, thank you.
Oh, no, thank you more, Lisa. Have a great night. God bless, and we'll talk soon.
Hopefully tonight we've saved some lives.
Yes, you know what? That's absolutely right. I hope we have, and I know that you're going to continue to do that. So God bless you with your great work, and we'll talk soon.
Thank you so much. Take care.
Oh, you're welcome. You too. You're welcome. All right, folks, 9:35 here. Have a great night. All right, folks, 9:35 here on the East Coast. Great episode tonight here, folks, on Blog Talk Radio. Via Insider NJ. And folks, you know, what can you say? I mean, when you have great guests like Lisa Gladwell, the chair of the New Jersey Recovery Advocates, you know, again, it makes my job easier because we're talking about the issues that matter to New Jersey residents. And again, if you miss any part of tonight's broadcast, you can go to www.blogtalkradio.com/politicallydirectNJ. You can do so from any PC, Mac, smartphone, or tablet. You can also go on Insider NJ's podcast page, which is www.insidernj.com/podcast. You can check out the podcast free of charge. And please share it on all of your social media. And if you have a topic or issue that you want to hear about next week or any feedback about tonight's show or previous guests, write to me, politicallydirectnj@yahoo.com. I love getting emails. I answer them, and I love to get back to you. Don't forget to follow the show on Instagram, folks, @politicallydirectnj. You can also follow me directly on Instagram at @your_favorite_Fernando. And, of course, you can follow me on Twitter at @ProfessorAfterUribe. Don't forget to like Politically Direct on Facebook as well. I appreciate that. Again, 500-plus likes and counting. So, again, I can't say enough, folks, about the support on social media for the show and certainly for Insider NJ. And speaking of Insider NJ, for the best journalism you'll find on a daily basis here in the Garden State, go to www.insidernj.com. Once you go on the main site, click on the subscribe button at the very top, and you'll be enrolled absolutely free of charge to our morning intelligence briefing delivered conveniently every morning to your inbox. And certainly if you're curious about what's going on in New Jersey, not just at the State House, but also the governor's office and also in all 21 counties, all of our assemblymen, assemblywomen, and state senators, everything that's going on in the political scene in New Jersey, nobody covers it better than Insider NJ. www.insidernj.com. And don't forget to start your day with Insider NJ. Folks, again, hope you've had a wonderful week here. Certainly, we have some great guests coming up here next Thursday. It's my privilege, and it's an episode I've been looking forward to for a very long time, exclusively here on Politically Direct. I will welcome the host of the Reporters Roundtable on NJTV, the man that I call the Dean of New Jersey Journalism, the great Michael Aaron, will join me next Thursday night here live at 8 p.m. on Politically Direct. So you don't want to miss this episode for anything in the world. Again, exclusively here on Politically Direct, NJTV's own host of Reporters Roundtable, and again, the Dean of New Jersey Journalism himself, the great Michael Aaron, joins us here on Blog Talk Radio. So whether it's on your morning commute, folks, getting that daily workout in, walking your dog, doing laundry or homework, maybe you're heading out to the stadium to tailgate this weekend for Sunday Fun Day, or you're taking an Uber or Lyft to go check out the NFL this weekend at your local bar or club, do me a favor, tune in on your smartphone, and you'll be happy that you did. And never forget that it's real, it's here, it is Politically Direct. Good night. Wait for it. Good night, Atlantic City. Better destinations, folks, here in South Jersey. You know, won some money over the summer at the casinos. Glad to see the Hard Rock is prospering. And hopefully we'll see some vibrance returning back to Atlantic City. So good night to all my good friends listening down there in AC. Folks, again, please party responsibly this weekend. Certainly enjoy the NFL. Certainly good to see the Yankees hopefully trying to sweep the Red Sox this week and trying to solidify their place for the American League wild card as the 2018 MLB season is winding down to a close. So, again, enjoy the weekend. Folks, again, please party responsibly. Let's go Cowboys this Sunday as they hopefully will move to 2-1 on this young 2018 NFL season. I'll see you next week, folks, here on Blog Talk Radio. And don't forget, let's keep on talking.